there are at least 13 separate systems inside the body of healing that endorphin has to do with, that it turns on the internal mechanisms of healing. Now, the endorphins, so far as the way that they work with appetite, the sight, sound, and smell of food may turn on your endorphin system, but that's only if it has turned off your nausea system. Now, every one of you has had nausea today. Now, you may not have understood that you did, but your blood nauseates you, your breath, your saliva, the air around you nauseates you. And because of the nausea that it feels, you turn on your anti-nausea center, so that most of us never experience nausea because of a properly functioning endorphin system. Now, I want you to remember that, because I'm going to quiz you on that in just a moment. At Sloan Kettering in New York, a group of researchers were working with endorphins. The researchers began to think that they would like to try something with some of the clinic patients at Sloan Kettering who were chronically nauseated. There are some poor people who don't have the same kind of good fortune that you do, that they experience no nausea. They have chronic nausea. Generally, in clinics for nausea patients, they try everything under the sun and nothing works for them. So some of the endorphin researchers decided that they would work with the patients having chronic nausea. So they wrote a letter and called all of those in who wanted to participate in a program. What they said in the letter was that they had received from England a new medication that only Sloan Kettering was licensed to deal with, and if the patients wanted to have some of that medication, they could come at 1:30 on Tuesday afternoon and they would be happy to put them in the program. The only thing that they would have to agree to was to come back once a week to get certain blood works and other checks to make certain that they were not being hurt by the medication. So on Tuesday at 1:30, they got a little vial of medication. So they went home with the instruction to take a small amount of that twice a day. Next week, when they came back, believe it or not, 80% of those who had received the medication had a complete clearing of their nausea. Now, use care. What do you think they had been given? Now, don't answer quickly, because that's a trick question a little bit. It requires thinking. Endorphins? Water? No, it wasn't water. Placebo? It wasn't a placebo. They'd already had placebos tried on them. They have everything tried on them. It's a very difficult disease to treat. What do you suppose they had? Anti-nausea substance? No. No, it wasn't that. Anybody know? Surely some of you who have been trained in medical circles will catch what it is. Well, what is it that makes people not be nauseated? Endorphins make you so that you're not nauseated. But what is it that turns on the endorphin system? What did we say caused it? No, not pain. What turns on the anti-nausea system? You weren't listening. Anything that makes you nauseated. So the first thing has to be nausea. Now, do you understand what it was that they gave to them in the little brown bottle? No. They gave them syrup of ipecac. Now, some of you know that syrup of ipecac will make you nauseated. So they gave them a little bottle of syrup of ipecac, which turned on their anti-nausea system. They produced endorphins in greater quantity. Something happens apparently to these people that they don't have a strong enough nausea to turn on their system. And so they simply gave them some syrup of Ipecac, which turned on their nausea. That turned on their endorphins, and that stopped their nausea. Now, endorphins are of many different kinds. One kind causes pain relief. Another kind causes anti-anemia. Another kind causes... You see, there are many different kinds in that family. And there are at least nine known for certain, 13 suspected of being present. And they suspect that they're going to find a lot more. And so do I. Now, these are ways that our food can affect us. Now, let's talk about some other ways that our food can affect us. Fats can affect us in a way that isn't so good. Some of you know, of course, that fats can make you start getting increased cholesterol inside your blood vessels. The more fats we eat, the greater the tax on the body. We may either go into a high cholesterol type of problem, or we can increase our risk of getting cancer by eating a high-fat diet, especially the free fats like margarine, mayonnaise, fried foods, cooking fats, salad oils, and that kind of thing, and all the animal products, meat, milk, eggs, and cheese, which represents the largest single place where Americans get fats. So fat, our food, can affect us in those ways. But now here is a way that you may not have understood about fats and the way that they affect us. Let's say that this is a tiny capillary, and inside this capillary are some red blood cells. Now, the red blood cells are charged. They have a charge on the membrane like this, every red blood cell. And it's a good thing they do, because you wouldn't be able to live if our divine designer had not thought of this minute detail on our red blood cells. So he put a charge there on each one, and any eighth grade schoolboy will be able to tell you what happens when two similarly charged bodies approach one another. What happens? They repel each other. And so these red blood cells won't stick together because of the fact that they have the charge on the membrane like that. But if you drink alcohol, Dr. Nisley from down at the University of South Carolina found that people who drink alcohol or those who eat fats have the substance in the blood, either the alcohol or the fats, in high quantity. And the more you take, the greater the likelihood that you will just neutralize all of the charges on the membranes of your red blood cells, and they begin to stick together like this. And so you get a wad of red blood cells. And they can't go through capillaries. And so after a fatty meal, we can study the oxygen content of the brain, and the oxygen content has simply gone down because of the fact that two things. One is that the flow characteristics of blood are made more viscid, that is, it moves more slowly like honey does on a cold morning, and also there are these little wads of red blood cells that make it so that you can't make your red blood cells go through your capillaries. Now, if you'll take the book Nutrition for Vegetarians and turn to page 43, you will see a little section there at the bottom of the right column of two capillaries with clusters of red blood cells in them showing this very thing. Now, while we're here, would you turn back to page 40, and let's just study the effect of sugar on the human body. Sugar doesn't do a lot of good things for us, especially if we eat a lot. Sugar has the likelihood of making it so that your white blood cells don't function so well. And let's just take a look at what happens if we have too much sugar. Let's draw a tube of blood. Here's our tube. We take this from an arm vein, and then we put some blood in it. And we spin that blood down in a centrifuge. And here are the red blood cells down here. And up above that, we have a layer of white blood cells right here. So let's stick a medicine dropper down into here and suck out this little layer of white blood cells. Then let's put those white blood cells in what we call a moist chamber. It's a solid piece of glass with a depression in it like that. So here we have the white blood cells in there. Now let's introduce some germs, some good juicy germs that white blood cells just love, like something like pneumococci or streptococci. Then we'll put a cover slip, a glass cover slip, over this so that the glass cover slip makes a completely airtight chamber. Put this in an incubator at, let's put that in Fahrenheit, 98.6 degrees for 30 minutes. At the end of that time, we'll take a look at the white blood cells, look at them under the microscope, and lo and behold, we find that each white blood cell has 14 germs inside of it, just like that. Now, that's provided you haven't eaten any sugar. If you have eaten 6 teaspoons full of sugar, your white blood cells won't be so active. They will not be as good soldiers. Take a look at on page 40 at the little table there at the bottom of the first column, and you'll see that if you take no sugar, your white blood cells can eat 14 germs in half an hour, but 6 teaspoons full of sugar make it so that we just erase 4 of these white blood cells right there and just do away with them. Then if you eat 12 teaspoons full of sugar, your white blood cells can only eat 5.5. 18 teaspoons full, 2. And 24 teaspoons full, only 1. Now somebody might say, well, I would just never, 6 teaspoons full of sugar, I would never take that. The very thought of it makes me get some of my anti-nausea endorphins to working for me. But if you take a half of a Coke, half of one of these big Cokes, that has 6 teaspoons full in it. If you take a nice-sized brownie, that has 6 teaspoons full in it. If you take a small piece of pie, that has 6 teaspoons full in it. And if you put a scoop of ice cream on it, it has 12. And if you put some whatever else people put on, maybe some syrup or some other things, you add more and more and more. A lawyer came to my office one time. He was not feeling well, and especially he did not feel well emotionally. He was tired of life. He was in a very large law firm there in Columbus, a very prominent law firm. He was from a very prominent family there in Columbus, Georgia. And when he came in, he and his wife came in to see me, and he said, "I am tired of my law partners. I'm tired of practicing law. I'm tired of living in Columbus, Georgia. And sometimes I think I'm tired of my family." So he sort of looked over at his wife, and she shook her head sadly. He said, "But I want to tell you, I don't use much sugar." And I said, "Well, fine, you'll be a good long step ahead." He had heard that we'd been doing some work with diet and behavior, and he was hoping that his problem was a physical one and not an emotional one. So I took a dietary history on this man who didn't use any sugar. His wife agreed with him that he didn't use any sugar. He hated sweets. And so I went through a dietary diary of the day before. Just asked him everything he'd had all through the day. And when I figured up the number of teaspoons full of sugar that this man who didn't like sugar, how much he had the day before, it was 19 teaspoons full of sugar. This man who didn't like sugar, didn't like sweets. Well, the average American eats 43 teaspoons full of sugar per day. And somebody eats a lot more than that because they eat a good bit of mine, almost all of it. And so somebody is eating a lot of sugar, and it affects us not in a good way. Now, let me ask you this. do you suppose that if it does this to our white blood cells, that it would do some bad things to some other cells in the body? Some cells that we wouldn't want to give a sample to any laboratory technician to check in the laboratory to see if they were working all right, such as muscle cells or bone cells, or how about your brain cells? Well, of course, we wouldn't want to give a sample of brain cells, not even 5 cc's, a little teaspoonful. So we have to check other ways and in the laboratory to see if the brain cells are not functioning well with sugar. Some of you may have been reading in the newspaper and in news magazines and health magazines about some of the people like Barbara Reed and Schoenthaler and Alexander Schaus and a number of other psychologists from all over the country who are doing work with prisoners and with delinquent children. They went to one prison where they had 18 to 22-year-old violent criminals incarcerated. They did just one thing. They just removed sugary junk foods from the prisoner's diet. And in the next 3 months, they found in these prisoners that they had had as a stable prison population, they found in these prisoners that they had an 82% reduction in assaults, 77% reduction in theft, 65% reduction in malicious horseplay, and a 55% reduction in refusal to obey orders. I thought when I read those statistics that every school principal and every parent should be aware of what sugar does to the mind of people. And I think that schools should have all the vending machines removed. I think that hospitals should have all the vending machines removed, and that prisons should have the vending machines removed, and we would be able to put forth less of a disciplinary effort to keep order in our schools and other places. We were down in North Carolina, and I presented this matter on the prisons, and a man stood up way back in the back, and he said, I want to say something to this group. So I said, fine. He said, my name is Mr. So-and-so Carter. I'm the principal of the Calvary Baptist Christian School. 2 years ago, we were having so many disciplinary problems that the parents of good students were taking their children out of the school, and some of my teachers were resigning. And one day, after one of my key teachers resigned, I was lying in bed that night thinking about what I could do with this school that was a Christian school, supposed to be just perfect in discipline and order. What could I do with this school that had so much in the way of disciplinary problems? He said, suddenly, like a bolt out of the blue, I knew I had the answer. Next morning, I called a teacher's meeting for that afternoon. When they gathered together, I passed out a letter that I was going to send home with every student to their parents. What I was going to do was this, that no student could attend that school who used any white sugar, either at home or away from home. No student could attend that school who watched television, either at home or away from home. He said the teachers were skeptical, but I sent it home anyway. He said the first thing that happened was that we had a 50% reduction in enrollment. And he said the next thing that happened was that we stopped having disciplinary problems. And he looked up at me and he said, Dr. Thrash, we don't have disciplinary problems in our school now. And I said, you mean you have a school of 50 students and you don't have any disciplinary problems? He said, that's right. We don't have any disciplinary problems in our school anymore. I believe that if we would be careful with the food of our children, that we could eliminate probably 9/10 of the disciplinary problems that we currently have with our children. If we would have meals on time, if we would eliminate brain stimulants and irritants like vinegar and caffeinated beverages and sugar and milk-egg-sugar combinations. Maybe you've been reading about the fact that milk and egg and sugar combinations are irritating to the blood vessels and irritating to the central nervous system. And when you use these in combination, they're much more effective in causing atherosclerosis and heart disease than when you use any one of them separately. So even if you should use them alone, you shouldn't use them together. In 1953, the Alcan Highway went through from Alaska to Canada. Prior to that time, Eskimos in Canada were taking 20 small pounds of sugar per year per Eskimo. Let me just write these figures for you so that you can see how they run. This was prior to 1953. They used about 25 pounds of sugar per person per year in Eskimo land. In 53, with the Alcan Highway, along went Dixie Crystals and Jack's cookies and a lot of other sweet things, and Cokes and Pepsis. And Alaskan Eskimo mothers began to take the top off a pop bottle, put a nipple on it, and give that to their children. They do to the present day, and they think they have given their children something that's important. In 8 short years, Eskimos went from 25 pounds of sugar per person per year to 125 pounds per person per year. Prior to 1950, they had never had carious teeth. They had never had gallbladder disease, never had diabetes. They had never had acne. There never had been a case of acne described in an Eskimo youth. There had never been one gallbladder operation in all of Eskimo land. When I was in medical school, my gastroenterology teachers were very perplexed. They just did not believe there was any relationship between gallbladder disease and fats and the taking in of fats, because all of the professors in these lines said, look at the Eskimos. They take 60% of their food calories in the form of fats. North Americans at the present time take 43% of their food calories in the form of fat. Most of these are from more than 23% of these are from animal sources, meat, milk, eggs, or cheese. So my gastroenterology professors just did not believe that gallbladder disease was associated with fat, with all that whale blubber and seal blubber that the Eskimos were using. But today, gallbladder surgery is the commonest operation done among Eskimos. The reason being that you add sugar to fats to an already high-fat diet, and you have a lethal combination. And Eskimos have had a lot of ill health since 53 that they didn't have before. They'd never been all that good in health, and now it's much worse. Acne is now as common in Eskimo youth as it is in the lower 48, and diabetes also as common. Now, carious teeth. The Eskimos had always tanned their leather by chewing the caribou hide. In fact, that's where we get the term, chewing the fat. The Eskimo women sit around all day and chew the caribou hide and make the skin soft and make their leather in that way. They made some very fine leather. But Eskimos don't use that method of tanning leather anymore because of the fact that they don't have teeth now. If they have teeth at all, it's just blackened snags. They have not been treated very well by all of this sugar that they have taken in. Now, probably there may be some questions by now that somebody may have, and if so, we would stop right now to take questions. If nobody has a question, I'd like to go on to my next topic, which is overeating. Does overeating affect us in any other way than that of making us gain weight? And the answer is yes, it does. There are several very common nutrients in the food that we eat that if we eat too much of it, it makes us have a problem with the way that we use our brains. Take sodium. Now, sodium is present in sodium chloride, or common table salt, but sodium is also present in all foods. So when you eat food at all, it puts sodium in your blood. Then if you get too much, if you eat too much food, you're going to get too much sodium, and that interferes with the production of norepinephrine. Now, norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter in the brain. The neurotransmitter, a neurotransmitter substance, is a substance that makes an electrical impulse jump across a junction between two nerves and pass a nerve impulse along. Norepinephrine has to do with states of alertness. It has to do also with cheerfulness. And it has to do with the way that we think, with the readiness with which we think. And if we don't make enough norepinephrine, if sodium interferes with it, then we might get drowsy in meetings. I hope you don't ever have anybody who has that problem, Pastor, in your meetings. And we're not having any problem tonight. I see everybody bright-eyed, especially right now. But sodium can so interfere with the production of norepinephrine that you simply can't stay awake at times when you really would like to. Now, another thing is potassium. Now, potassium has to do with the transmission of a nerve impulse along the nerve itself. So it just, as the nerve is, we have potassium inside the nerve cell, the extension of the nerve that goes all the way from the spinal cord down to the big toe, let's say. And then we have sodium on the outside of the cell. When we send a nerve impulse along, what happens is that potassium very quickly jumps out, sodium very quickly jumps in, and this lasts only 1/500th of a second, and it's just zip, and they go back again. Sodium goes back out, and potassium goes back in. So it's a very quick exchange. If we eat too much, we get too much potassium in the bloodstream. That goes to the brain and to the nerves everywhere and interferes with this jumping back and forth. And so we can have a sort of dullness of mind, or we can have confusion of the mind because of eating too much. Many times people come to me and they say, I am often just confused. I can't think well. I can't concentrate. When I look up a telephone number, I have to look at it four times before I can get the number dialed. Why? Well, one of the reasons is just eating too much. Another reason is a sensitivity to fats. I had a lady who was a book salesman. She went around from house to house selling books. She lived out in Colorado. I saw her out there one time, and she consulted me about a problem that she had, and that was being what she called foggy-brained. She wanted to know what to do. I told her everything that I could think of. Walk, drink plenty of water, don't eat too much food, get plenty of sleep at night, then pay close attention. She said she did all of that. And I would hear from her from time to time through the years, always, no matter what else she was consulting me about, she always wanted to know if I had discovered anything particular for her being foggy-brained. She said that when she was a youth, she had been keen of mind, had no problem whatsoever. But now that she was about 47, she was having difficulty. When she was about 54 or 55, she wrote to me one time and said she had 3 months off. She was leaving the company that she'd been working with out in Colorado and was coming to the East and was going to work with a company here selling books. And she wanted to know if we had a place that we could use her services just for her room and board for the 3 months that she had off. I told her, come along, we'd try to find a place for her somewhere in our little health institute. So she was assigned to a home a sort of dormitory that we have for there, and there were, it was a small girl's home. There were only three girls in that home, and she was assigned to be their cook. They were students in our physician assistant course. And during the time that she was their cook, she had to cook an oil-free diet. Now, some of you will remember about 10 years ago when Nathan Pritikin began to be sort of a popular figure in American health circles. Nathan Pritikin was promoting an oil-free diet. You may have heard of it. It was written up a lot in health magazines. Well, these three girls were all enthusiasts of the oil-free diet. That's what they wanted to have cooked. So she was required to cook the oil-free diet for them. But she made a regular diet for herself. This went on for about 3 weeks. Two diets being served, regular diet and oil-free diet, from the same kitchen. Well, she got a little tired of that and began to serve only a fat-free diet. And she ate with the girls. The next week, she saw me across the campus and came running up to me and said, "Dr. Thrash, I have discovered why I have been foggy-brained." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Fats." And I said, "Well, don't you suppose that being out here in this nice Alabama air and being under this beautiful sky and being away from all of your problems, don't you suppose that's the reason?" "Oh, no, it's fats. I know it is." So I said, "Well, do a little experiment. Add fats back to your diet and let's see what happens." She said, "All right, I'll do it." So she went home, started making a regular diet again. And she told me that she was foggy-brained again. So she tried that three times, and finally she and I were both convinced. That was about 8 or 10 years ago. And during that length of time, I have told probably 40 people who complained to me of being foggy-brained in one way or another that they ought to go off fats and see if that would help. And a large percentage of them have told me that it does help. So if you happen to have difficulty in concentrating, try that and see if that won't help you. Also, try not eating too much. There are many benefits to be derived from just sitting down and eating what you're supposed to and not eating anymore. Now, let's see what's next. Let's go to caffeine. Would you turn to page 114 in the book, Nutrition for Vegetarians, and let's just discuss some things about using the caffeinated beverages. Caffeine is an interesting substance. As you can see there on page 114, you can see that caffeine and adenine are very close together in organic chemistry shorthand. In fact, they look so much alike that when a little embryo is developing, when it starts to develop ovaries or testes, the embryo will take caffeine instead of adenine selectively, will select it out and put that in the testes or in the ovaries before birth. Now, some researchers took some radio-labeled caffeine with a little radioactive marker on the caffeine and gave that to some pregnant rats. And they discovered that when they examined the testes, they found the radioactive substance in the testes or in the ovaries. Some other researchers gave some coffee or tea or colas or chocolate. They could do it with any. They gave that to rats prior to the birth of their offspring. And then they took the little rat pups and tried to teach them how to walk through a maze. And they discovered, to their amazement, that these rats could not be taught how to walk the maze as readily as other rats could. Some other researchers found that in studying mice, they found that mice would do antisocial acts, what we might call rat crime. Males would attack females. Normal rats never do that. Males would attack the young. And so they said that these researchers felt that the coffee drinking habits of Americans might have to do with the escalating crime rate that we are now seeing in this country. So Some other researchers did the same thing, gave caffeinated drinks to some rats, and they found that liver weights and brain weights of the little rat pups were smaller, were lighter weight than in those not receiving caffeine in their prenatal period. Now, there are some very damaging things that have been published recently in the medical literature concerning the caffeinated beverages, coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate. One is that the caffeinated beverages can increase your risk of getting high blood pressure. Hypertension is definitely more present in those who habitually use the caffeinated beverages. A second thing, cancer. Several cancers are more common in coffee drinkers. If a woman drinks one cup of coffee per day, she increases her risk of getting cancer of the bladder by 3 times. If a woman drinks 2 cups of coffee per day, she increases her risk of getting cancer of the ovary by 2.2 times. And there are several other cancers that are known to be associated with the intake of caffeinated beverages, even when they're decaffeinated. So using Sanka or decaf does you no good so far as protecting you against increasing your risk of getting cancer from these beverages. Study was done published in the American Journal of Psychology for this past year, came out in January of this year, showing that people who use the caffeinated beverages have 3 emotional and mental disorders more than do others. These are anxiety, depression, and hostility. So if you have a hostile housemate, there may be something in the diet causing the problem. So start there. That's one of the easiest things to handle. That's a lot easier than the psychiatrist's couch, which, generally speaking, won't do very much for these types of disorders. Now, so far as the psychological problems or psychiatric problems that patients have related to caffeine, caffeinated beverages put homogentisic acid in the urine. And I think it is no happenstance that people who have schizophrenia also excrete more homogentisic acid in the urine than do normal people. Caffeinated beverages are likely to cause a lot of problems with the skin. Often, people who have skin disorders or eye problems or hair disorders will have these things to clear up very nicely if they stop using the caffeinated beverages. Now, any questions up to this point? Question. You mean if a person has the tendency to be a profuse sweater?
Right.
Nervousness is one thing. Heredity is another. Being acclimatized to the Arctic but living in the tropics can cause it too. Now, the way that we can do this to ourselves, just living in the same, we don't have to go to the Arctic to acclimatize ourselves to Arctic weather. If we become chilled for several hours a day, such as during sleep or during the time that we're getting dressed in the morning, or perhaps you work out of doors, you may acclimatize yourself to the Arctic. Women often do this with the gossamer clothing that they wear indoors, and then they stay habitually chilled, feet habitually chilled, hands habitually chilled, arms habitually chilled, and thighs and legs and so forth, and they become acclimatized to the Arctic, and then if they just put on a very light sleeve, they sweat. And so they are uncomfortable because they sweat if they put on clothing, but their feet are habitually closed, you know, habitually cold. You know, women do have habitually chilled. Women are born with cold feet. There are even some diseases that go along with having cold feet. In Germany, the people over there, the doctors over there speak of cold feet cystitis. Since cystitis is a woman's disorder and it occurs in women who have cold feet, and the bladder becomes irritable when the feet get cold, and the blood to the all the pelvic organs, uterus, vagina, ovaries, tubes, as well as bladder, is reduced when the feet are chilled. And it's unhelpful for a woman to have habitually chilled extremities. You might wonder how you could get warm feet since women are born with cold feet. Is it just an hereditary thing that makes women have cold feet? And the answer is no. The reason that they have cold feet is because they have cold thighs. So if you will put lots of clothing on the thighs and on the legs and be sure to cover the knees well, then you shouldn't have any difficulty. Some women will tell me, I don't know what it is. It must be some poor circulation because look at me. I have on 3 pairs of socks and a large pair of boots, and I still have cold feet. And then when I examine the situation and find that she has nothing on her thighs except maybe just a little pair of nylons, I just tell her that she is just insulating her icicles down there and it's not doing a bit of good. All right, a question over here. Fats of nuts, you may eat nuts, provided you don't use too many. Now, a dish that has nuts in it, let's say you're going to have since I'm a vegetarian, I will tell you about a vegetarian roast. A vegetarian roast is a composite of something like grains and maybe some onions, something like bread dressing, that has maybe some nuts in it. Any dish of this nature that you make, whether it's granola or a vegetarian roast or any other thing that you make that has nuts in it, some kind of salad, never put more than 1/6 to 1/10 of the whole dish as nuts. To put more in makes it unhelpful for us. And don't serve more than one dish that has nuts in it at any one meal. So you may use some nuts, but do use them sparingly. Let's say you're going to use nuts as a main dish. Then you may use nuts as your main dish. You'll need a little bit more than you would need if they were going to be a side dish. Here is how to tell how much nuts to get. Reach your hand in the nut bin like that and close your hand over the nuts, and that's the amount that you should eat for yourself depending on the size of your hand. Now, no going in the bin like that. You can't come up like that, as many of us would be happy to do. Question?
Yes. Sorry about sodium.
Yes.
What about salt?
Salt is sodium chloride.
I know. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. Okay. Glad you mentioned that. Salt is a real problem in the United States. Especially it is in the South. We take from 7 to 15 grams of salt per day in the South. And that's a teaspoonful is 5 grams. So you can see how heavy we are on salt. The American Heart Association recommends to all Americans that we not take more than 1/2 to 1 teaspoonful of salt per day. Now, if you have high blood pressure, you should take zero, none at all. It's not cut down, it's cut out if you have high blood pressure. That's at least for a while. The time may come when you can use a little. What we do at the Health Institute is we have people who come there, cut out all salt. They have to sit at our salt-free table. Now, we often have people who come to our institute who say, Dr. Thrash, you just won't have to worry about me concerning salt. I have been salt-free for the last 13 years. And we say, well, good. You'll be a good long step ahead. Then we assign them to sit at our salt-free table in the dining room. And they say, this food certainly is bland. And then I know something about the last 13 years. A lot of people feel that they are salt-free when they really are not. And when you're fighting high blood pressure, when you're trying to get it under control, you need to be without salt. No salt at the factory, no salt at the stove, and no salt at the table if you have high blood pressure. Now, once you get the blood pressure under control, after you're stable, then you can take your own salt shaker. You still cook in the same way. You still purchase your food in the same way. No salt from the factory, no salt at the stove, but you can have a salt shaker that has your name written on it. And you put a half teaspoonful of salt in that shaker every morning. You may use all of that on your grits in the morning if you wish to, but that's all. No more during the day. That's the last that you can have. Now, if you have some left over that day, you can't add that to the next day. You have to start out all over again the next day. But if you will do that, you will be able to keep, and if you do that, and number two, you take all dairy products from your diet. Now, dairy products are naturally high in sodium because of the fact that mammary glands are very closely related to sweat glands. Sweat glands put out a lot of salt in their secretions, and mammary glands put out a lot of salt in milk. So you can't take any dairy products, not in any kind of reasonable quantity. So generally speaking, those who are working with high blood pressure, trying to keep the salt down, say no dairy products of any kind. Number three, don't take any processed foods. That would be processed meats or processed vegetables, processed baked goods. You just about have to build everything from the ground up unless it actually says on it, no salt. Number four, don't even approach a vending machine. There isn't anything in a vending machine that a person on a salt-free diet can take. If you will do that, you will be able to keep your total salt content of your diet down below 1,000 milligrams per day, which is in the therapeutic range. Generally, at our Health Institute, we expect that within just a matter of 2 or 3 days, a person's blood pressure will be coming right down on our diet and our exercise program and some hot baths. Hot baths will invariably bring the blood pressure down. Now, it's temporary, but it's a very good way to bring the blood pressure down. Question in the back.
Can you elaborate on teas?
Herb teas? Okay, question is about teas and what I meant when I was talking about teas. That's Pekoe tea, such as you get down at the grocery store when you go down to buy tea. But you may use herb teas. There are several that are quite good beverage teas, such teas as Caffrey tea, mint tea, gossip tea, lemon mint tea. There are a number of really good herb teas on the market these days. You should just go down to the health food store and experiment a little. Question?
How do you sweeten the herb teas?
All right, question is, how do you sweeten the herb teas? Don't sweeten herb teas. What you do is just brew them lightly. Take a tea bag and dip it 3 or 4 times in and put that aside. That's all. Why do we want tea? Anyway, why do we want any beverage? It's for the water. That's how we got started on teas in the first place. You remember, in Europe, in the Middle Ages, water was just not palatable at all. And so all of this about teas and the Boston Tea Party and all of that had to do with the fact that we got started drinking tea in Europe in the Dark Ages because of the unpalatability of water. Now, if we took a poll here tonight, probably 50% of people would say that they don't consider water to be palatable. They just find the greatest difficulty in drinking water. So what we want is just, we want a little coloring and a little flavoring to water. What is a Coke? It's just colored, flavored, sweetened water. The only nutrient in it. And it's very expensive. How much does a Coke cost these days? That's a lot for a glass of water. Yes. All right. Question is about wood dust being sawdust being put in certain things, breads and other bakery products. I don't know anything about that. I do know that it is planned, and I do know that there are some people who have made breads with that. But whether they're on the market, I just haven't heard. Has anybody heard? Anybody know? I've heard that it was going to be. They had to label it a certain way, did they?
Yeah, they told
Did they have to put it sawdust? Lady in the back. Wood pulp for that. There it is. There it is. What is its purpose? Isn't it to make a bulk without giving calories? Just to increase one's fiber? Okay. That would be reasonable. Question back here. All right. Question is about cheese. I didn't get the last part of your question. Okay. Is there any way that any kind of cheese can be used? And the answer is, hardened cheese? No, it is wholly unfit for the human stomach. Ask any physician, and he will just tell you it's wholly unfit. It has various substances in it that make it so that they injure the interior of our blood vessels, causes people who have asthma to increase their asthma. It causes those who have high blood pressure to increase their high blood pressure. Those who have irritable colons, it increases their problems. Wholly unfit for human consumption. And if you want to have a little treatise on that, we have a little printed sheet in our health emphasis seminar syllabus, which will be available on our health education materials table at the end of our program. We'll take a number of questions. Those of you who have questions right now, would you raise your hands and I'll give you a number, and then I'll answer only these questions, and then Janet has a part of the program. So raise your hands until I give you a number. Number one. The lady there, number two. The gentleman, number three. That gentleman, number four. Number five. Number six. Number seven. Number eight. Number nine. Number ten. Okay. Number one.
You mentioned something about the mammary gland and salt. What about mother's natural milk?
Okay. The question is the difference between mother's milk and cow's milk, so far as the content of salt, it's more than three times more in cow's milk than in mother's milk. More salt. Yes, mother's milk has salt in it too, but cow's milk has more than three times. Number two. Oh yes, that's what we've been doing. You know, this American diet is killing us. We need sweeping reforms in it. And by the way, while I'm on this, I'm going to talk with you about the vegetarian diet in a little while, and I'll have some special instruction for you on that. Oh, you need some good instruction. Call me sometime and I will tell you some things to eat. Question number three.
Do you mean cheese as a whole, not whatsoever, any type?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
You mentioned about cheese.
Yes.
No good.
Yeah.
You mean of any type, any way, shape, form?
Well, let's see. What did you have in mind? Yes, all those. That's right. Cheese. What is ordinarily defined as cheese? Wholly unfit. What?
Grated.
You mean like Parmesan? Yes, learn to make a good substitute Parmesan. There are substitutes for all cheeses. 25 years ago, if you had asked me what my favorite food was, like a flash, it would have come back ice cream. If you'd said, well, what's your second favorite food? Like a flash, I would have said cheese. Cheese was harder for me to give up when I began this health kick that I've been on for the last 20 years. It was harder for me than alcohol and tobacco and coffee and 20 other things that I gave up. Cheese was the hardest. But you know, we have nowadays cheeses that melt, those that spread, those that dip, those that slice. You can just do anything with cheeses that you can just shake out of it, just shake like this and out falls a cheese. If you are equipped in your kitchen to make it, and all you have to do to get equipped is get some lemon juice and some some potatoes and some rice or some carrots or something like that, common things, and make a nice cheese. It's easy to make them. Question number 4. Goat's cheese, no fermented product. When you ferment grains, what do you get?
Alcohol.
Is that fit for the human stomach? Not a bit of it. It's a poison. And as a physician, I'm certainly not going to recommend to people that they take any poison. When you ferment grapes, what do you get?
Wine.
Well, same thing with wine. When you ferment milk, what do you get? Cheese. I don't believe in taking any fermented product, not soy sauce. Soy sauce has aflatoxin in it, which increases your risk of getting cancer. It's the commonest. Aflatoxin is the most potent cancer-producing agent that we know. So all you have to do is to make a nice little substitute soy sauce. Easiest thing to do. Or buy lechoy. Lechoy is a non-fermented soy sauce made by an acid digestion method. And can you get lechoy soy sauce here? There? It's not fermented. At least it doesn't have aflatoxin in it. I don't believe in taking sauerkraut or kimchi or anything else that's fermented. We're dealing with something very precious in the human body. Anything that will deteriorate it, I'm against it. Okay, question number, what are we now, 5? Okay. Yes. Good point. A good question. Asthma?
I've been having it really bad the last month.
Uh-huh. I would be very happy to talk with you, but just for everybody, asthma in many instances, while it may not be caused by a food, it is often made uncontrollable by food sensitivities. Food sensitivities can be divided into several categories. So far as asthma is concerned, you often have a cause and a trigger. And the food can be either the cause or the triggering agent. So it's a little tricky to find what it is. But we have had some very good results at the Health Institute helping patients discover the cause of their asthma. In our little book, Health Emphasis Seminar Syllabus, on page 10, we have a list of foods that are most likely to be involved. And in our book called Natural Remedies, in Appendix A, we have a list of most of the foods that have ever been described in the medical literature as causing sensitivities. We have those listed. And what we recommend is that the person who has asthma just take the whole list and eliminate them at once. Then, once you've done that, You need to have a little experience in dealing with foods, if at all possible, so that you know how to go about making yourself a diet without all of those things you're going to be eliminating. It's a help to be a vegetarian, too, because that generally people who are vegetarians know a little bit more about how to serve a variety of things than do others. So I'll be happy to talk with you. Once your symptom of sensitivity, whether it be hay fever or asthma or skin disease or whatever, once it goes away, then you start adding back the foods that you have taken away one at a time every 3 to 5 days until you find those foods that you're sensitive to. Question number 6. A person should be able to get plenty of potassium from a natural diet. Don't use refined grains, refined sugars, alcohols, refined proteins, and you should have no difficulty at all. Do you? Potassium does something special for nerves. It may not be a deficiency of potassium, but rather the specific toxicity that potassium has for nerves that makes your twitch go away.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. 7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.